responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely.
Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Owner and by storing firearms safely.
Store all your...
All right, welcome back to Friday edition of the Earl Ingram Show with my co-host Sandy Williams. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You know, Sandy, I wanted to ask you about the term neocon. And I remember the first time I heard neocon. And I think the first time I heard neocon, George Bush Sr. might have been the president, and they were talking about a new world order.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really understand then. I understand a little more now. But we really need to go back to what that is and the changes that occurred in the world, and especially in our nation, when he talked about new world order and the term neocon came into existence. Because since then, our world has changed and the rest of the world has changed.
And so, the way we have dealt with the rest of the world has changed. So what existed, you know, the Henry Kissinger, the famous Secretary of State, who's still alive and still pretty sharp, under Nixon, he basically came out of the traditional school of international affairs, which was that it was called, he called it realpolitik. It was the notion that you recognize the power of other countries, and that you had to take that into account in your dealings in the world, and you only would exert your power and influence to the extent that it related to the real political interest of your country, the real interest, the real strategic interest, and that you didn't exercise your power elsewhere. You didn't expend it there because you wouldn't be willing to follow it up with all of your power if it wasn't a matter of real strategic interest. So you wouldn't dabble, for instance, in the Ukraine if you weren't willing to send troops to the Ukraine, because you wouldn't want to confront and inflame a confrontation with Russia, for instance, because it was clearly in their backyard. So Henry Kissinger,
they're still doing the Cold War.
This is the Cold War. This was the way, but this was the traditional way for international affairs generally. Because you wouldn't want to inflame a situation where you weren't willing to actually carry through. So you basically pulled your horns in to the extent that you only exercised your muscle where you needed to from an important standpoint. When the Soviet Union collapsed, we had a bipolar world. Everyone recognized there were two great military powers in the world, Russia or the Soviet Union and the United States. There was no other powerful military. In fact, the NATO at the time had been sort of created so that the United States could be the powerful entity, so that the European countries wouldn't go to war with one another like they had in World War I and World War II and drag the United States and the rest of the world into it. So the United States planned NATO to be this confluence of alliance of all the countries in Europe to keep them at peace with one another, with the United States being the primary military power behind it. And then we had the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed, we had the United States remaining as essentially
lone superpower.
Lone superpower. And that was a very unique situation. And it came right at the end of the first Bush administration, and then through Clinton. A fellow named Paul Wolfowitz was sort of a brain behind it. And the neocons, as neoconservatives, as they became called, took the view that America was in this unique position, that we were this democracy, that we would exert our influence across the world to create what was called Pax Americana, the peace of America, where we would exert our power across the world. But, of course, we were only exerting it where it was actually of strategic interest to it, which usually related to
oil
and natural resources. number one. And number two, we could exert it because there was a vacuum. China was not powerful in 1992. Russia was a vacuum. It was on its knees. It had all these nuclear missiles, but it didn't have a government or an army that had any kind of capacity to do anything. So we developed this concept, and the concept was that we would do what was our foreign policy would be designed to achieve and maintain this singular American dominance over the world, both economically and militarily. And we would exert our foreign policy to make sure that both of those circumstances continued. And from a military standpoint, that's a very expensive kind of a position. It also ignored the fact that Russia was a sleeping giant, that it remained the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. It also was ignorant of the fact when it was formulated that China was rapidly becoming a world economic power, which of course would also bring with it the capacity to be a world military power, because there's no world economic power that wouldn't also in parallel develop its military capacity. And so by 2015, 2020, we have an entirely different world, but we still have a bunch of people who are mired in the neocon outlook. And I would say that Blinken is one of those. And I think that undoubtedly Joe Biden, our president, was birthed in the Cold War and came through the 1990s and came out of it with neocon outlook about America's position in the world. So we find ourselves today with this neocon influence. It's not well explained to the American people, but clearly our policies towards China have vacillated between a neocon policy of doing everything we can to make sure that America remains the dominant economic power in the world, which of course means that we have to do things to thwart the rate at which China's economy is growing, because China's economy, at least up until this year, when it's looked like it's got some faltering experience, is on a trajectory to bypass our economy.
But you know, Sandy, you said earlier, China is the number one global power economically.
It's going to be, and soon.
And there's nothing we can do ever to prevent that.
Well, we can try to put things on the tracks to slow down the freight train, right? So you can you can put furniture there and you can put houses there, but that freight train's going to get through, okay? And so that's the problem. What we're facing is an inevitability that the Chinese have a organized economy, they have an educated population, they've got all the ingredients that will drive them in the direction of becoming a larger economy than the United States, and it will occur. The question is when. But if we design our policies towards thwarting that, what we're trying to do is thwart the inevitable. It's sort of like the buggy makers trying to sabotage the automobile manufacturers so that they don't take over.
So you know, Sandy, the fact that the neocons that are remaining and that mindset, you know, Joe Biden from that era, and we were talking earlier about the meeting with him with Japan and South Korea and all of those things, directly knowing that this boogeyman is coming, the American people have to realize it's not going to change our lives.
Well, we just have to be careful. We have to make sure that we don't formulate our foreign policy like the English did in 1750 around mercantile issues, mercantile being commercial economic issues. So that the wars in the 1800s and 1700s between countries were usually fought over economic dominance, okay, some economic issue. And that's not what we should be fighting wars over in the 21st century.
And this is important. This whole conversation is important because, Sandy, it impacts whether or not our nation can do the things that you keep saying we need to be doing for the citizens and the people who live in this country who clearly are going to be facing some difficult times because the money is limited and the money can't continue to be spent trying to hold off and stave off whether or not China is going to continue to, and so we're fearful of all of those things. So our money goes into those kinds of things.
Well, prosperity and happiness do not require economic dominance. Okay, there's plenty right. of there's plenty of examples around the world of countries that are achieving very significant prosperity with the happiness and welfare of their people without dominating the world. And so we've got to decouple in our mind this notion that we need to dominate the world, because the world, you know, whether we like the verbiage that Putin and others are using now about having a multipolar world, it's going to happen. I mean, we have to recognize that the world is going to return to a circumstance in which there is not one power in the world that calls the shots. There's going to be the need for various countries to coexist peacefully, but to coexist in recognition of one another and one another's spheres of influence.
You know, Sandy, I don't know who it was who said this, but they were right on point, and he said it a long time ago. America, the world is not in America. America is in the world. And we had a mentality that the world was in America. We only saw America, and we only saw ourselves. You're a globe traveler. A lot of people in this country aren't. And so we only see our country, and we don't see the other nations and those and people just like us who want the same things we want, right? They want a fair opportunity to feed their families. They want to be able to own maybe a little piece of land for themselves, and they want a future for their families. That's all many of them want, right?
Well, that's all anyone in the world wants, any individual or family in the world wants. And I think what we have to do is just be careful about what we decided to be afraid of, because developing a military and the expenditures associated with our defense have to be premised on an evaluation of what we need to be afraid of, right? Because militaries are there to keep us safe from the things that otherwise we need to be afraid of. And I think that's where we've become very unrealistic in our evaluation of the world, is the things that we need to fear and therefore dip deep into our pockets to expend money to make sure that we don't need to have those fears.
So, Sandy, I'm not concerned that this is a conversation that is a difficult one to have, because many Americans don't understand it or don't want to understand it, but we're going to have it anyway because it's important. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be back.
Wait, now it's going to rain? It is summer in Wisconsin.
As much as we love it, we love to hate it too. Find a forecast you can count on, along with the in-depth details you need, only from the Civic Media Weather Team.
These extended conditions have led us into a flash drought. Sitting in these above average temperatures with minimal rain has swiftly altered the local climate.
Your weather and more for your part of Wisconsin.
On your local Civic Media radio station and streaming on the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. A blend of clouds and sun this afternoon with highs around 76. Winds out of the west, 5 to 10 miles an hour. Lows around 57 tonight, partly cloudy skies. Highs around 84. Tomorrow, bright sunshine. Mainly sunny skies and calm Sunday with daytime highs.
Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. And, you know, this conversation may not be your cup of tea. It may not be, you know, something that any of us think that we have any control over. But at the root of all of this is why we can't afford things, or why we say we can't afford things, why we say we can't afford health care, why we say we can't afford a daycare, all those things these are the reasons that we can't afford those things. And I believe that if the American people knew these things, be they Democrat or Republican, and understood why the wealthiest nation on earth can't help the elderly, you know, can't do these things for the American people. If the American people knew why, I don't think the American people, Sandy, would be willing to sacrifice their own standard of living for these fears that segment of and leaders in our country.
Well, it's kind of self-destructive behavior. And off the air, I came up with an analogy that I sort of want to repeat on the air. You know, addicts do things. They always find an excuse to keep doing it, right? That's part of addictive behavior. Well, here we in the United States, we got involved with Iraq and Afghanistan and spent trillions, more than $1 trillion on these long-term activities, which got very little publicity in the United States after they got started.
But, and didn't benefit the nation.
But it became a habit that we continued for a long time. And almost as soon as we stopped, in fact, if CJ would connect the dots, almost immediately after we stopped and withdrew from Afghanistan, Ukraine began, and we're now in feeding money into Ukraine at a rate that must be in the $200 billion a year range, or well over $100 billion a year, which is an enormous sum of money, which strikes me as a continuation of the habit, okay? So, you know, we've got a new rationale for it, but we always, like I said, the addict always has a rationale for continuing. But what we should understand is that our country, for a significant period of time, decades, has always found the rationale for continuing to expend enormous sums of money outside of our country on military activities. And those military activities are not only cause direct expenditures, but they also ramp up our defense budget at orders of magnitude. I think we looked it up before, but I think in 1995 or 2000, you looked it up, and our military budget was $330 million.
Yeah.
And now we got $860 billion. I mean, I should use a B, not an M, for all those words. So we've got, you know, a military budget that's not tripled, but almost more than doubled, and almost tripled in a very short period of time. And that's not inflation. That some of that's inflation. Very little of it is, because we've had very little inflation during that time period. That's all about the appetite of the American people, which, or the American government, to spend money. And that money is expended at the, you know, at the expense of other things that could be done, particularly as we become increasingly aware of the fact that we can't use deficits. One of the problems with this military appetite is that ever since George Bush II, we have financed our military affairs without increasing our taxes. In fact, we've decreased taxes only with the result of increasing our deficits. You know, people had this trickle-down Reaganomics kind of idea. We could reduce taxes and increase our GDP and increase our revenue for the government. That hasn't been the case, okay? We've had increasing deficits since the Bush administration all the way along. Now, we've had some of those deficits were necessitated by recession and near-depression situations, some of them by pandemic. But the main thing is that we've gotten into this habit of deficit expenditure at the same time as massive increases in military budgets, all of which is going to put the pinch on our ability to do things for Tom, Dick, and Mary.
You know, Sandy, all of those things having been said, and the American people, here's another prime example. Facing all of these different things that future lives and American citizens are going to face, more and more difficult lives, and you just know it doesn't have to be that way. Resources are there that if we just got out of that mindset that, again, we just are stuck into and can't get out of. And it's the reason why I want to keep talking about it, Sandy. It's the reason why with your knowledge base, whether or not it's boring to people or not, or people, and I think it's not boring, it's the fact that they just don't know. They're not aware, and they can't believe that our nation would do something like this. They love our country. They love, you see them, they love the flag. They love all of that, all of those things, and they trust, and yet they don't know that behind the scenes, this is what's going on. And so I personally, as an American, I don't care to be the most powerful military in the world and to flex our muscle all over the globe. I don't see what's beneficial in my life for that, Sandy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we're led to believe. The Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us at that same number. It's Fridays with Sandy Williams. Sandy, the horrible, horrible situation in Maui, where arguably they say 111 is the worst fire in the history.
Yeah, worst wildfire.
In the history.
In modern American history. But it's 111 and still counting because we've got hundreds of people unaccounted for. And now cell phone towers are back up and methods of communication are back up. So I think hope is dwindling about hundreds
finding
of people.
Somebody.
Yeah, hundreds of people.
You know, Sandy, the argument is, okay, whose fault is it? Well, George Bush was sitting around, and we saw,
but it goes back. Remember when George Bush was accused because of the poor FEMA response? And I suspect it's okay to, I think, criticize what the government is capable of doing in response
to. In New Orleans, right,
for the hurricane.
Right.
But this finger-pointing that goes on after the tragedy in Uvalde and then the amount of attention that's been paid to this poor police officer who apparently possibly was too fearful to go in and save lives. And, yeah, that's also a circumstance. But is that really something that ought to be on the national news and ought to be in my mind and the name of this person ought to be in my mind or what have you? And now we've got this tragedy in Lahaina. And people want to politicize it and say, well, where's Donald Trump? Why isn't he there? What would he do if he was there?
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden.
Right.
Why isn't Joe Biden there? What would he do if he were there? Which reminds me of the problem in Puerto Rico when they had the hurricane there Donald Trump finally did show up and distributed paper towels. People, he was criticized for that. But what is a president going to do other than have a photo op and express sympathy in a circumstance like this? I just think that we try to personalize and politicize everything. And it's unfortunate.
You know, Sandy, that situation, nothing could have been done. For the most part.
You mean this fire?
Yeah.
Well, I can see doing a lessons learned. And, okay, now they're looking at Hawaiian Electric and saying, okay, should this electric utility,
which understood
the risk of the fire, should they have identified it publicly and started a cleanup operation to make it less likely that there would be these brush fires? Those are the kind of constructive lessons learned that could help you in the future. Should they have turned on the alarms or not? That's a lessons learned type proposition. Blaming the individual who's decided not to turn them on because he was fearful that the people would think there was a tsunami strikes me as a fact circumstance that, okay, that's something to be known, but do we need to personalize it? Does this person need to be vilified? The poor soul has already resigned from office. Not wanting to be in the middle of all of the focus of this thing.
You know, to somehow point the finger at this one guy for all of those deaths, there's just something about that doesn't sit well with me. You can't blame one man for what took place. And I'll also say this, Andy. I was reading where the hurricane seasons are getting ready to start. the water is so warm that hurricanes are going to be it's going to be horrible.
Yeah.
This hurricane season, and many others are going to lose their lives. And so we just have to understand that natural disasters, in many instances, how can you plan for that?
Yeah, I mean, I think lessons learned are a very important thing, and we ought to be doing it. We ought to be doing it with the government, making sure we have a competent government. We ought to do it in our personal lives. We ought to do it in our corporate lives. But you can't shoot the messenger and have a lessons learned experience. I've talked about this article of the comparison between Toyota's corporate culture in the 80s, where they celebrated the person who came forward with the problem so they could solve it, and General Motors, where they shot the messenger and basically demoted the people who came forward right. with problems, and therefore they didn't deal with them, didn't discover them.
Deming, I think the guy's name.
Well, Deming was the guy that was the basis for the Toyota type
process
experience.
Control, right?
Continual improvement.
Right.
But that's the difference, okay? We don't want to have the 1980s GM mentality where we shoot the messengers. We want to have a lessons learned, let's make it better approach to everything. So if we did that, we'd start solving these social government problems we have as well. We start solving our healthcare issues, our healthcare costs, our healthcare availability, our healthcare outcomes. We'd start solving education. I just heard today that they're predicting and experiencing extreme inflation in the cost of child daycare. We'd start dealing with the problems of child daycare, which bleed into the availability of workers and creating worker shortages in the economy without daycare availability. There's all these things that we should be doing lessons learned about and not shooting the messenger.
You know, Sandy, it's so easy to say the Democrats did it, the Republicans did it. In an instance like this, and in most others, let's stop that.
Well, that's all messenger shooting.
Yeah.
who did it? Who shot John is not anywhere near as important as how do we avoid John getting shot in the future.
You know, Sandy, these things have happened. They're going to happen. There right now is an argument about whether or not we don't have enough money in FEMA. There's not enough money put there. And we do know that these things are coming and they're going to need these resources. I was listening the other day to an argument that Joe Biden hasn't put enough money in Maui yet. Well, how can you... What is there? The place has been leveled. Well, they should. And I was listening to the guy named Brown, who was the head of FEMA when Katrina.
Bush? Oh, yeah. That was the guy that when Bush said
Brown,
Brownie,
yeah.
that Brownie yeah, Brown, had done yeah. such a great job. He called him Brownie.
I was listening to him the other day.
Was he being critical?
Yes.
Ah.
He was saying, well, number one, they shouldn't. They should have their. They should. Their footprint should not be in this other island. It should be right there. And they're short. And they've only got 20 some odd cadaver dogs running around. They should be going all over and bringing in hundreds and hundreds of cadaver. Well, it's easy for him to now sit back and be critical of what's taking place when his Waterloo was there. You know, he kind of resented the fact of that kind of thing. But Sandy, that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, I think we ought to get rid of this. Like I said, the who shot John analysis is different than constructive lessons learned processes. And what we need to get to is constructive lessons learned. Let's figure out how to do this better. And that is best done when we aren't trying to figure out who to blame,
right.
Individually who to blame. Because usually and almost always, it's processes that fail, not individuals that fail. Individuals within processes fail, but the reason they fail is because of the process, not so much because of their individual failure. And so
let's go to Bill from McConnell Mall. Good morning, Bill. How are you?
great. By the way, I like your topic about who shot who and, you know, who do we point the finger at. On all of that, there's nothing wrong to say, hey, they're not doing enough. I don't see any wrong with that. But then you have to have a concept of how you can make it better. If you're just there to accept the negativity and just stay on that and destroy everything, you're not contributing. All people, Americans, I don't care, Republicans, Democrats, once we get through this, hopefully, cleansing for our democracy, let's have a fresh look at everything. If you don't like something, there's nothing wrong with that, but then let me hear your alternative plan that you think it make it better. Step two, with a lot of the things that go on in our country, the humanitarian issues, the illegals, the you just mentioned child care. There is so much. I really believe, and I'm even going to mention to our church, it's time for the Council of Churches to step up and handle some of these humanitarian needs. That's basically what churches are about. I don't know any church that doesn't preach humanitarianism. I think we can use this rough spot in our country to come out twice as good. I think even the Republicans might be acceptable to this, that you don't have to like the plan, but then you got, if you don't like it, tell us how you're going to make it better immediately. Not, well, we got to have a committee and go into investigation. Now, we want to know how you can fix it. What do you guys think?
Well, Bill, how can you fix it is all about lessons learned, right? That's what lessons learned processes are. What happened and how do we fix it? How do we make it better? And that's why I say if we could shift America to that outlook rather than just simply who shot John, we'd actually start moving forward. I'm afraid that who shot John just always kicks the can down the road, and it always is a way to ignore the processes that are the problem. And really, like I said, in almost every circumstance, in every corporation, in every government, it's processes that fail. Individuals end up being the way the processes fail, but it's processes that fail.
Thank you very much for the call, Bill. You know, Sandy, Maui is going to take a generation. That's just looking at it, it's been leveled.
Yeah.
And so there are certainly some toxic things that are all over that island right now. It's going to take a generation. They'll be talking about that a generation from now. We can't expect it to be fixed and up and running overnight.
Well, what's interesting is the people who want to attack the premise of government also expect government to step in and solve these problems instantaneously. So, of course, to solve problems instantaneously, you have to have a very competent process and a competent, well-funded government that's capable of stepping in and solving problems in a very quick manner. Okay, so we've got kind of people arguing against themselves. Let's get rid of government, but let's make sure that when we need government, it does a very good job and it's very well-funded. Okay. And so those two arguments, when you start making them in the same breath, begin to sound kind of silly.
Yeah, it does, because there's a debate right now, even long before this, about how much money goes into FEMA. Republicans are saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, there can't be enough money that goes into FEMA, right?
The premise is, I mean, you have to decide what you insure, what the government is going to stand behind and insure for its people. But insurance is then funded sufficiently to cover the risks that are being covered by the insurance. And FEMA is basically our disaster insurance program for the federal government to protect people from natural disasters in the country. Now, we have to decide the extent, are we going to help people rebuild their homes if it's in the floodplain in the bayou?
Right.
You know, we used to do that in the 50s. Hopefully we stopped doing that, because all that means is we're going to have to spend money every 4 years when that house floats down the river. But so we have to decide what the range is of what we're going to insure and protect. But once we decide that, the government has to fund it. That's what insurance is all about.
You know, Sandy, the difference with Maui is they don't show any life, right? You know, it's just
desolate.
Yeah, desolate.
Yeah.
And we do know that people were there and life was there. There's no sign of life. So even when I'm watching the news and, you know, and maybe you could see some children or some, you know, homeless people, there's just nothing.
Yeah, it definitely looks like the result of like a bomb.
Yeah, nuclear weapon or something.
Yeah.
Listen, we've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back.
Level.
All right, welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us that same number the last few minutes of the Earl Ingram Show on Friday with my co-host Sandy Williams. Let's go to our good friend Sharky from Racing. Hey, good morning to you, Sharky. How you doing, man?
Top of the morning to you, gentlemen. It's appreciate your broadcast today, and it just kind of makes me a little eerie. They say that of about 111 bodies there, they're only identifying right now at 6 or 7. And I'm thinking, what was that other than a flame? And so I think back, and I hate to bring it up, but Tulsa, 1921, the burning of Tulsa. I don't know if there's any familiarities between the two comparisons, but it's scary. But I'm also hearing reports on the ground, the boots on the ground in Hawaii, that people are already offering to buy properties that are burnt out. So the realtors and the developers are on this like a bum, you know, on a pastrami sandwich. And that makes me sick. And this whole world of tells me that in my thoughts and studies, they say in Wisconsin alone, as an example, we have of all of our developments as far as rentals, 54% of our homes in Wisconsin now are rentals. And it's scary to hear that. What a perfect way to drill somebody into a home and drum them out of the home out to the curb. And while the millionaires make more millions. I'm just brainstorming. May not make sense.
Well, you know, I think you're reciting some issues that need to be focused on. They are possibly related, but there certainly is a relationship between the way in which people will react to crises. Some of them want to take advantage of it, you know, and profit from it. And that's always sort of a sad process to watch, you know.
Hey, Sharky, man, thank you very much. Tell our friends in Racine we said hello, and we can't wait to get back.
We love you back. We love you
all right.
Back anytime.
All right, thank you. Let's go to CJ. CJ.
Well, thanks for the call again. The Maui situation, and isn't just about pointing fingers. Again, it's how did we get here? There were warnings that, you know, land management has not been done right. Control burns. Utility companies were not maintaining electrical wires. And this gentleman that refused to turn on the water was stated that water's to be revered and not used. Well, it's not just about pointing fingers. It's about accountability. And this, I would say, politicized is that people are crying out that it's climate change. No, it's poor management. That's what it's about. And this gentleman should be brought up on charges for murder because he refused to turn on the water until it was too late. So it's about accountability, and that's what I want. I want accountability no matter where it lands, which side of the aisle. It's not about right or left to me. It's about accountability for their actions. and this man refused to turn on the water until it was too late.
Well, yeah, I think accountability is obviously an important issue in the world, and accountability is part of how we assure ourselves of the conduct that's required going forward. But accountability is just a little part of it, and lessons learned and constructive looking forward and making sure that our course in the future is less likely to have and experience the problems we've had in the past. That's what civilization is about. That's what improvement is about. And that's what we're talking about with respect to constructive kind of lessons learned processes. And I simply would assert that what America is short of right now is a constructive lessons learned approach. We're focusing too much on who shot John and accountability, which we have to work on, and we have to do that. But that's not the end of the game. That's like a small element of the game, and the biggest part of this game needs to be, how do we make things better? How do we make things as good as they can be?
All right, Tom, you got the last of. No, go ahead, Tom, quickly.
Yeah, I can't let CJ get away with all this craziness that he spouts. First off, these people that are running these electric companies, it's no longer in the commons. It's no longer with we the people. It's no longer a public utility. These are private corporations. And yes, all they care about is profit, and all they care about is making sure that their stockholders are taken care of. Same thing that happened up in Northern California with the Paradise Fire. This is what happens when you put these different utilities in the hands of private corporations instead of we the people, public corporations.
Hey, Tom.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Julie from Franklin, good morning. You got the last of it, Julie. How you doing? You say what?
Hi, good morning, guys. I do think, though, that accountability is what we're lacking these days in lots of aspects of our life. Nobody's held accountable for what they do. If they break the law, if they, you know, hurt somebody or whatever. And I think that's why we've gotten to where we are with, you know, nobody fears.
Well, quickly, Julie, what you're talking about is everybody being accountable to the law, right? And of course, we've got now the ex-president of the United States in that position, and we've got people on the other side arguing that that's a witch hunt, that he shouldn't be held accountable for whatever reasons I don't understand. But it seems like accountability is not always sauce for the goose and the gander. And we need accountability, but accountability doesn't solve the problems of the future if we don't accompany it with lessons learned and constructive improvement.
Well, absolutely, but I think accountability is a lesson learned. When you're held accountable for something you do wrong, that's a lesson learned. You don't do it again.
Well, the problem, what I'm talking about is process, and lessons learned usually are applied to processes. Accountability relates to people and conduct within the processes, and so those are two different things. If you have a process that's faulty but someone fails to follow the process, they should be held accountable, but it's the process ultimately that is the failure.
Hey, Julie, thank you for the call. Have a great weekend. I wish we had more time, but we're done. Sandy, as always, great having you on. Great talking to you. Great having you back. Calvin, great weekend. Great week. Have a great weekend. I'll be back on Monday. Sandy and I, have a great weekend. See you later.